A dagger, lady? And for what? To use as a dagger. Cambardia, you know I mean no ill. He looked strangely at me, but got it. I put it on at my belt where the sword had hung yesterday. Farewell, Bardia, said I.
Farewell, lady. Do you go for longer than a night?
I don't know. I don't know, said I. Then, all in haste and leaving him to wonder, I went out and went on foot by the lane and joined Graham. He set me up on the horse, touching me, unless it was my fantasy, as one who touched a snake or a witch, and we began. Nothing could be less like that day's journey and the last. I never got more than yes, lady, or no, lady, out of Graham all day. There was much rain, and even between the showers the wind was wet. There was a grey driving sky, and the little hills and valleys, which had been so distinct with brightness and shade for Bardia and me the other day, were all sunk into one piece. We had started many hours later, and it was nearer evening than noon when we came down from the saddle into that secret valley. And there at last, as if by some trick of the gods, which perhaps it was, the weather cleared, so that it was hard not to think the valley had a sunlight of its own, and the blustering rains merely ringed it about as the mountains did. I brought Graham to the place where Bardia and I had passed the night, and told him to await me there and not to cross the river. I must go over it myself. It may be I shall recross it to your side by nightfall, or in the night. But I think that whatever time I spend on this side, I will spend over yonder near the ford. Do not come to me there, unless I call you. He said, as always, yes, lady, and looked as if he liked this adventure very little. I went to the ford, about a long bowshot from Graham. My heart was still as ice, heavy as lead, cold as earth, but I was free now from all doubting and deliberating. I set my foot on the first stone of the crossing and called Psyche's name. She must have been very close, for almost at once I saw her coming down to the bank. We might have been two images of love, the happy and the stern. She so young, so bright-faced, joy in her eye and limbs. I burdened and resolute, bringing pain in my hand. "So I spoke truly, Maya," she said as soon as I had crossed the water and we had embraced. "The king has been no hindrance to you, has he? Salute me for a prophetess." This startled me a moment, for I had forgotten her foretelling. But I put it aside to be thought of later. Now I had my work to do. I must not, now of all times, begin doubting and pondering again. She brought me a little way from the water, I don't know into what part of her phantom palace, and we sat down. I threw back my hood and put off my veil, and set down the urn beside me.
"Oh, Orwell," said Psyche, "what a storm cloud in your face! That's how you looked when you were most angry with me as a child."
Was I ever angry? Ah, Psyche, do you think I ever scolded or denied you, without grieving my heart 10 times more than yours? Sister, I meant to find no fault with you. Then find no fault with me today either, for indeed we must talk very gravely. Now listen, Psyche. Our father is no father. Your mother, peace upon her, is dead, and you have never seen her kindred. I have been... I have tried to be, and still I must be, all the father and mother and kin you have, and all the king, too.
Maya, you have been all this and more since the day I was born. You and the dear fox are all I ever had.
Yes, the fox, I'll have something to say of him, too. And so, Psyche, if anyone is to care for you, or counsel you, or shield you, or if anyone is to tell you what belongs to the honour of our blood, it can be only I.
But why are you saying all this, Orwell? You do not think I've left off loving you because I now have a husband to love as well. If you would understand it, that makes me love you. Why, it makes me love everyone and everything more.
This made me shudder, but I hid it and went on. I know you love me, Psyche, said I, and I think I should not live if you didn't, but you must trust me too. She said nothing. And now I was right on top of the terrible thing, and it almost struck me dumb. I cast about for ways to begin it. "You spoke last time," I said, "of the day we got the thorn out of your hand. We hurt you that time, Psyche,
but we did right. Those who love must hurt. I must hurt you again today. And, Psyche, you are still little more than a child. You cannot go your own way. You will let me rule and guide you. Orwell, I have a husband to guide me now. It was difficult not to be angered or terrified by her harping on it. I bit my lip, then said, "Alas, child, it is about that very husband, as you call him, that I must grieve you." I looked straight at her eyes and said sharply, "Who is he? What is he?" "A god," she said low and quivering, "and I think the god of the mountain." "Alas, Psyche, you are deceived. If you knew the truth, you would die rather than lie in his bed." "The truth? We must face it, child. Be very brave. Let me pull out this thorn. What sort of god would he be who dares not show his face?" "Dares not? You come near to making me angry, Orwell." "But think, Psyche. Nothing that's beautiful hides its face. Nothing that's honest hides its name. No, no, listen. In your heart you must see the truth, however you try to brazen it out with words. Think. Whose bride were you called? The brute's. And think again. If it's not the brute, who else dwells in these mountains? Thieves and murderers, men worse than brutes and lecherous as goats, we may be sure. Are you a prize they'd let pass if you fell in their way? There's your lover, child. Either a monster, shadow and monster in one, may be a ghostly, undead thing, or a salt villain, whose lips even on your feet or the hem of your robe would be a stain to our blood. She was silent a long time, her eyes on her lap. "And so, Psyche," I began at last, tenderly as I could, but she tossed away the hand that I had laid on hers. "You mistake me, Orwell. If I'm pale, it is with anger. There, sister, I've conquered it. I'll forgive you. You mean, I'll believe you mean, nothing but good. Yet how or why you can have blackened and tormented your soul with such thoughts... But no more of that. If ever you love me, put them away now." "Blackened my thoughts, they're not only mine. Tell me, Psyche, who are the two wisest men we know?" "Why, the fox, for one. For the second, I know so few. I suppose Bardia is wise in his own way."
"You said yourself that night in the five-walled room that he was a prudent man.
Now, Psyche, these two, so wise and so different, are both agreed with each other and with me concerning this lover of yours. Agreed without doubt, all three of us are certain, either shadow brute or felon." "You have told them my story, Orwell. It was ill done. I gave you no leave. My lord gave no leave. Oh, Orwell, it was more like batter than you." I could not help it if my face reddened with anger, but I would not be turned aside.
"Doubtless," I said, "there is no end to the secrecy of this husband, as you call him."
"Child, has his vile love so turned your brain that you can't see the plainest thing, a god? Yet on your own showing he hides and slinks and whispers mum and keep counsel and don't betray me like a runaway slave." I'm not certain that she had listened to this. What she said was, "The fox, too? That is very strange. I never thought he would have believed in the brute at all."
I had not said he did, but if that was what she took out of my words, I thought it no part of my duty to set her right. It was an error helping her towards the main truth. I had need of all help to drive her thither.
"Neither he, nor I, nor Bardia," said I, "believes for one moment in your fancy that it is the god, no more than that this wild heath is a palace. And be sure, Psyche, that if we could ask every man and woman in Glome, all would say the same. The truth is too clear."
"But what is all this to me? How should they know? I am his wife. I know."
"How can you know if you've never seen him?"
"Orwell, how can you be so simple? How could I not know?"
"But how, Psyche?"
"What am I to answer to such a question? It's not fitting. It is... And especially to you, sister, who are a virgin."
That matronly primness from the child she was went near to ending my patience. It was almost, but I think now she did not mean it so, as if she taunted me. Yet I ruled myself.
"Well, if you're so sure, Psyche, you will not refuse to put it to the test."
"What test? Though I need none myself." "I've brought a lamp and oil. See, here they are." I set them down beside her. "Wait till he, or it, sleeps. Then look."
"I cannot do that."
"Ah, you see, you will abide no test. And why? Because you're not sure yourself. If you were, you'd be eager to do it. If he is, as you say, a god, one glimpse will set all our doubts at rest. What you call our dark thoughts will be put to flight, but you daren't."
"Oh, Orwell, what evil you think. The reason I cannot look at him, least of all by such trickery as you'd have me do, is that he has forbidden me."
"I can think, Bardia and the fox can think, of one reason only for such a forbidding, and of one only for your obeying it."
"Then you know little of love."
"You fling my virginity in my face again, do you? Better it than the sty you're in." "So be it. Of what you now call love, I do know nothing. You can whisper about it to Redivar better than to me, or to Ungit's girls, maybe, or the king's doxies. I know another sort of love. You shall find what it's like. You shall not—"
"Orwell, Orwell, you are raving," said Psyche, herself unangered, gazing at me, large-eyed, sorrowful, but nothing humble about her sorrow. You'd have thought she was my mother, not I, almost hers. I had known this long time, that the old, meek, biddable Psyche was gone for ever, yet it shocked me afresh.
"Yes," I said, "I was raving. You had made me angry. But I had thought, you will set me right, I don't doubt if I'm mistaken, that all loves alike were eager to clear the thing they loved of vile charges brought against it if they could. Tell a mother her child is hideous. If it's beautiful, she'll show it. No forbidding would stop her. If she keeps it hidden, the charge is true. You're afraid of the test, Psyche."
"I am afraid, no, I'm ashamed, to disobey him."
"Then even at the best, look what you make of him, something worse than our father. Who that loved you could be angry at your breaking so unreasonable a command, and for so good a reason?"
"Foolishness, Orwell," she answered, shaking her head. "He is a god. He has good grounds for what he does, be sure. How should I know of them? I am only his simple Psyche."
"Then you will not do it? You think, you say you think, that you can prove him a god and set me free from the fears that sicken my heart, but you will not do it?"
"I would if I could, Orwell."
I looked about me. The sun was almost setting behind the saddle. In a little while she would send me away. I rose up. "An end of this must be made," I said. "You shall do it. Psyche, I command you."
"Dear Maya, my duty is no longer to you."
"Then my life shall end with it," said I. I flung back my cloak further, thrust out my bare left arm, and struck the dagger into it till the point pricked out on the other side. Pulling the iron back through the wound was the worst pain, but I can hardly believe now how little I felt it.
"Orwell, are you mad?" cried Psyche, leaping up.
"You'll find linen in that urn. Tie up my wound," said I, sitting down and holding my arm out to let the blood fall on the heather. I thought she might scream and wring her hands or faint, but I was deceived. She was pale enough, but had all her wits about her. She bound my arm. The blood came seeping through fold after fold, but she staunched it in the end. My stroke had been lucky enough. If I'd known as much then as I do now about the inside of an arm, I might not, who knows, have had the resolution to do it. The bandaging could not be done in a moment. The sun was lower and the air colder when we were able to talk again.
"Maya," said Psyche, "what did you do that for?"
"To show you I'm in earnest, girl. Listen, you have driven me to desperate courses. I give you your choice. Swear on this edge, with my blood still wet on it, that you will this very night do as I've commanded you, or else I'll first kill you and then myself."
"Orwell," said she, very queen-like, raising her head, "you might have spared that threat of killing me. All your power over me lies in the other."
"Then swear, girl, you never knew me break my word." The look in her face now was one I did not understand. I think a lover, I mean a man who loved, might look so on a woman who had been false to him.
and at last she said, "You are indeed teaching me about kinds of love I did not know. It is like looking into a deep pit. I'm not sure whether I like your kind better than hatred. Oh, Orwell, to take my love for you, because you know it goes down to my very roots and cannot be diminished by any other newer love, and then to make of it a tool, a weapon, a thing of policy and mastery, an instrument of torture? I begin to think I never knew you. Whatever comes after, something that was between us dies here."
"Enough of your subtleties," said I. "Both of us die here in plainest truth and blood, unless you swear."
"If I do," said she hotly, "it will not be for any doubt of my husband or his love. It will only be because I think better of him than of you. He cannot be cruel like you, I'll not believe it. He will know how I was tortured into my disobedience. He will forgive me."
"He need never know," said I.
The look of scorn she gave me flayed my soul. And yet this very nobleness in her, had I not taught it to her? What was there in her that was not my work? And now she used it to look at me as if I were base beneath all baseness. "You thought I would hide it? Thought I would not tell him?" she said, each word like the rubbing of a file across raw flesh. "Well, it's all of a piece. Let us, as you say, make an end. You grow more and more a stranger to me at each word. And I had loved you so, loved, honoured, trusted, and while it was fit, obeyed. And now... But I can't have your blood on my threshold. You chose your threat well. I'll swear, where's your dagger?" So I had won my victory, and my heart was in torment. I had a terrible longing to unsay all my words and beg her forgiveness, but I held out the dagger. The oath on edge, as we call it, is our strongest in gloam. "And even now," said Psyche, "I know what I do. I know that I am betraying the best of lovers, and that perhaps before sunrise all my happiness may be destroyed for ever. This is the price you have put upon your life. Well, I must pay it." She took her oath. My tears burst out, and I tried to speak, but she turned her face away. "The sun is almost down," she said. "Go. You have saved your life. Go and live it as you can." I found I was becoming afraid of her. I made my way back to the stream, crossed it somehow, and the shadow of the saddle leaped across the whole valley as the sun set. Chapter 15. I think I must have fainted when I got to this side of the water, for there seems to be some gap in my memory between the fording and being fully aware again of three things, cold, and the pain in my arm, and thirst. I drank ravenously. Then I wanted food, and now first remembered that I had left it in the urn with the lamp. My soul rose up against calling Graham, who was very irksome to me. I felt, though I saw it to be folly even at the time, that if Bardia had come with me instead, all might have been different and better. And away my thoughts wandered to imagine all he would be doing and saying now if he had, till suddenly I remembered what business had brought me there. I was ashamed that I had thought even for a moment of anything else. My purpose was to sit by the ford watching till I should see a light, which would be Psyche lighting her lamp. It would vanish when she covered and hid it. Then, most likely far later, there would be a light again. She would be looking at her vile master in its sleep. And after that, very, very soon after it, I hoped, there would be Psyche creeping through the darkness and sending a sort of whispered call, "Maya! Maya!" across the stream, and I would be halfway over it in an instant. This time it would be I who helped her at the ford. She would be all weeping and dismayed as I folded her in my arms and comforted her. For now she would know who were her true friends, and would love me again and would thank me, shuddering, for saving her from the thing the lamp had shown. These were dear thoughts to me when they came, and while they lasted. But there were other thoughts, too. Try as I would, I could not quite put out of my head the fear that I had been wrong. A real God? Was it impossible? But I could never dwell on that part of it. What came back and back to my mind was the thought of Psyche herself, somehow, I never knew well how, ruined,
lost, robbed of all joy, a wailing, wandering shape for whom I had wrecked everything. More times than I could count that night, I had the wish, tyrannously strong, to recross the cold water, to shout out that I forgave her her promise that she was not to light the lamp, that I had advised her wrongly. But I governed it. Neither the one sort of thoughts nor the other was more than the surface of my mind. Beneath them, deep as the deep ocean sea whereof the fox spoke, was the cold, hopeless abyss of her scorn, her unlove, her very hatred. How could she hate me when my arm throbbed and burned with the wound I had given it for her love? "Cruel Psyche, cruel Psyche," I sobbed. But then I saw that I was falling back to the dreams of my sickness. So I set my wits against it and bestirred myself. Whatever happened, I must watch and be sane. The first light came soon enough and vanished again. I said to myself, though indeed once I had her oath, I never doubted her faith to it, "So, all's well this far." It made me wonder, as at a new question, what I meant by well, but the thought passed. The cold grew bitter. My arm was a bar of fire, the rest of me an icicle, chained to that bar but never melted. I began to see that I was doing a perilous thing. I might die, thus wounded and fasting, or at least get such a chill as would bring my death soon after. And out of that seed there grew up in one moment a huge foolish flower of fancies. For at once, leaping over all question of how it should come about, I saw myself laid on the pyre, and Psyche, she knew now, she loved me again now, beating her breast and weeping and repenting all her cruelties. The fox and Bardia were there too. Bardia wept fast. Everyone loved me once I was dead. But I'm ashamed to write all these follies. What checked them was the next appearing of the light. To my eyes, long swilled with darkness, it seemed brighter than you would have thought possible. Bright and still, a home-like thing in that wild place. And for a time longer than I had expected, it shone and was still, and the whole world was still around it. Then the stillness broke. The great voice, which rose up from somewhere close to the light, went through my whole body in such a swift wave of terror that it blotted out even the pain in my arm. It was no ugly sound. Even in its implacable sternness it was golden. My terror was the salute that mortal flesh gives to immortal things. And after, barely after, the strong soaring of its incomprehensible speech, came the sound of weeping. I think, if those old words have a meaning, my heart broke then. But neither the immortal sound nor the tears of her who wept lasted for more than two heartbeats. Heartbeats, I say, but I think my heart did not beat till they were over. A great flash laid the valley bare to my eyes. Then it thundered as if the sky broke in two straight above my head. Lightnings, thick, following one another, pricked the valley, left, right, near and far, everywhere. Each flash showed falling trees. The imagined pillars of Psyche's house were going down. They seemed to fall silently, for the thunder hid their crashing. But there was another noise it could not hide. Somewhere away on my left, the walls of the mountain itself were breaking. I saw, or thought I saw, fragments of rock hurled about and striking on other rocks and rising into the air again like a child's ball that bounces. The river rose so quickly that I was overtaken by its rush before I could stumble back from it, wet to my middle. But that made little odds, for with the storm there had come a tyrannous pelting rain. Hair and clothes were already a mere sponge. But beaten and blinded though I was, I took these things for a good sign. They showed, so it seemed to me, that I was right. Psyche had roused some dreadful thing, and these were its ragings. It had waked. She had not hidden her light soon enough. Or else, yes, that was most likely, it had only feigned to be sleeping. It might be a thing that never needed sleep. It might, no doubt, destroy both her and me. But she would know. She would, at worst, die undeceived, disenchanted, reconciled to me. Even now we might escape. Failing that, we could die together. I rose up, bent double under the battery of the rain, to cross the stream. I believe I could never have crossed it, the deep, foaming death race it had now become, even if I had been left free to try. I was not left free. There came as if it were a lightning that endured. That is, the look of it was the look of lightning, pale, dazzling, without warmth or comfort, showing each smallest thing with fierce distinctness, but it did not go away. This great light stood over me as still as a candle burning in a curtained and shuttered room. In the centre of the light was something like a man. It is strange that I cannot tell you its size. Its face was far above me, yet memory does not show the shape as a giant's. And I do not know whether it stood, or seemed to stand, on the far side of the water, or on the water itself. Though this light stood motionless, my glimpse of the face was as swift as a true flash of lightning. I could not bear it for longer. Not my eyes only, but my heart and blood and very brain were too weak for that. A monster, the shadow brute that I and all Gloam had imagined, would have subdued me less than the beauty this face wore. And I think anger, what men call anger, would have been more supportable than the passionless and measureless rejection with which it looked upon me. Though my body crouched where I could almost have touched his feet, his eyes seemed to send me from him to an endless distance. He rejected, denied, answered, and worst of all, he knew all I had thought, done, or been. A Greek verse says that even the gods cannot change the past, but is this true? He made it to be as if from the beginning I had known that Psyche's lover was a god, and as if all my doubtings, fears, guessings, debatings, questionings of Bardia, questionings of the fox, all the rummage and business of it had been trumped-up foolery, dust blown in my own eyes by myself. You, who read my book, judge, was it so? Or at least had it been so in the very past, before this god changed the past? And if they can indeed change the past, why do they never do so in mercy? The thunder had ceased, I think, the moment the still light came. There was great silence when the god spoke to me. And as there was no anger, what men call anger, in his face, so there was none in his voice. It was unmoved and sweet, like a bird singing on the branch above a hanged man. Now Psyche goes out in exile. Now she must hunger and thirst and tread hard roads. Those against whom I cannot fight must do their will upon her. You, woman, shall know yourself and your work. You also shall be Psyche. The voice and the light both ended together as if one knife had cut them short. Then in the silence I heard again the noise of the weeping. I never heard weeping like that before or after. Not from a child, nor a man wounded in the palm, nor a tortured man, nor a girl dragged off to slavery from a taken city. If you heard the woman you most hate in the world weep so, you would go to comfort her. You would fight your way through fire and spears to reach her. And I knew who wept, and what had been done to her, and who had done it. I rose to go to her, but already the weeping was further away. She went wailing far off to my right, down to the end of the valley where I had never been, where doubtless it fell away or dropped in sheer cliffs toward the south, and I could not cross the stream. It would not even drown me. It would bruise and freeze and bemire me, but somehow whenever I grasped a rock, earth was no use now, for great slabs of the bank were slipping into the current every moment, I found I was still on this side. Sometimes I could not even find the river. I was so bewildered in the dark, and all the ground was now little better than a swamp, so that pools and new-formed brooks lured me now this way, now that. I cannot remember more of that night. When day began to break, I could see what the god's anger had done to the valley. It was all bare rock, raw earth and foul water. Trees, bushes, sheep, and here and there a deer floated in it. If I could have crossed the first river in the night, it would not have profited me. I should have reached only the narrow bank of mud between it and the next. Even now I could not help calling out Psyche's name, calling till my voice was gone, but I knew it was foolishness. I had heard her leaving the valley. She had already gone into the exile which the god foretold. she had begun to wander weeping from land to land, weeping for her lover, not, I mustn't so cheat myself, for me. I went and found Graham, a wet, shivering wretch he was, who gave one scared glance at my bandaged arm and no more, and asked no questions. We ate food from the saddlebags and began our journey. The weather was fair enough. I looked on the things about me with a new eye. Now that I'd proved for certain that the gods are, and that they hated me, it seemed that I had nothing to do but to wait for my punishment. I wondered on which dangerous edge the horse would slip and fling us down a few hundred feet into a gully, or what tree would drop a branch on my neck as we rode under it, or whether my wound would corrupt and I should die that way. Often, remembering that it is sometimes the gods' way to turn us into beasts, I put my hand up under my veil to see if I could feel cat's fur or dog's muzzle or hog's tusks beginning to grow there. Yet with it all I was not afraid, nevertheless. It is a strange, yet somehow a quiet and steady thing, to look round on earth and grass and the sky, and say in one's heart to each, "You are all my enemies now. None of you will ever do me good again. I see now only executioners." But I thought it most likely those words, "You also shall be Psyche," meant that if she went into exile and wandering, I must do the same. And this, I had thought before, might very easily come about, if the men of Gloam had no will to be ruled by a woman. But the god had been wide of the mark. So then they don't know all things? If he thought he could grieve me most by making my punishment the same as Psyche's, if I could have borne hers as well as my own. But next best was to share. And with this I felt a sort of hard and cheerless strength rising in me. I would make a good beggar-woman. I was ugly, and Bardia had taught me how to fight. Bardia? That set me thinking how much of my story I would tell him. Then, how much I would tell the fox. I had not thought of this at all. Chapter 16. I crept in by the back parts of the palace, and soon learned that my father had not yet come home from the hunting. But I went as soft and slinking to my place as if he had. When it became clear to my own mind, it did not at first, that I was hiding now not from the king but from the fox, it was a trouble to me. Always before he had been my refuge and comforter. Pooby cried over my wound, and when she had the bandage off, that part was bad, laid good dressings on it. That was hardly done, and I was eating hungrily enough, when the fox came. "Daughter, daughter," he said, "praise the gods who have sent you back. I have been in pain for you all day. Where have you been?" "To the mountain, grandfather," said I, keeping my left arm out of sight. This was the first of my difficulties. I could not tell him of the self-wounding. I knew, now I saw him, I had not thought of it before, that he would rebuke me for putting that kind of force upon Psyche. One of his maxims was that if we cannot persuade our friends by reasons, we must be content and not bring a mercenary army to our aid. He meant passions. "Oh, child, that was sudden," he said. "I thought we parted that night to talk it over again in the morning." "We parted to let you sleep," said I. The words came fiercely, without my will and in my father's own voice. Then I was ashamed. "So that's my sin," said the fox, smiling sadly. "Well, lady, you have punished it. But what's your news? Would Psyche hear you?" I said nothing to that question, but told him of the storm and the flood, and how that mountain valley was now a mere swamp, and how I had tried to cross the stream and could not, and how I had heard Psyche go weeping away on the south side of it, out of Gloam altogether. There was no use in telling him about the god. He would have thought I had been mad or dreaming. "Do you mean, child, you never came to speech with her at all?" said the fox, looking very haggard. "Yes," I said, "we did talk a little earlier." "Child, what is wrong? Was there a quarrel? What passed between you?" This was harder to answer. In the end, when he questioned me closely, I told him about my plan of the lamp. "Daughter, daughter," cried the fox, "what demon put such a device in your thoughts? What did you hope to do? Would not the villain by her side, he, a hunted man and an outlaw, be certain to wake?
And what would he do then but snatch her up and drag her away to some other lair? Unless he stabbed her to the heart for fear she'd betray him to his pursuers, why, the light alone would convince him she'd betrayed him already. How if it were a wound that made her weep? Oh, if you had only taken counsel!
I could say nothing. For now I wondered why, indeed, I had not thought of any of these things, and whether I had never at all believed her lover was a mountainy man. The fox stared at me, wondering more and more, I saw, at my silence. At last he said, "Did you find it easy to make her do this?" "No," said I. I had taken off while I ate the veil I had worn all day, and now I greatly wished I had it on.
"And how did you persuade her?" he asked.
This was the worst of all. I could not tell him what I had really done, nor much of what I'd said. For when I told Psyche that he and Bardia were both agreed about her lover, I meant what was very true, both agreed it was some shameful or dreadful thing. But if I said this to the fox, he would say that Bardia's belief and his were sheer contraries, the one all old wives' tales, and the other plain workaday probabilities. He would make it seem that I had lied. I could never make him understand how different it had looked on the mountain.
I spoke with her, said I at last. I persuaded her.
He looked long and searchingly at me, but never so tenderly since those old days when he used to sing "The Moon's Gone Down," I on his knee.
"Well, you have a secret from me," he said in the end. "No, don't turn away from me. Did you think I would try to press or conjure it out of you? Never that. Friends must be free. My tormenting you to find it would build a worse barrier between us than your hiding it. Some day... But you must obey the God within you, not the God within me. There, do not weep. I shall not cease to love you if you have 100 secrets. I'm an old tree, and my best branches were lopped off me the day I became a slave. You and Psyche were all that remained. Now, alas, poor Psyche, I see no way to her now, but I'll not lose you."
He embraced me. I bit my lip not to scream when his arm touched the wound, and went away. I had hardly ever before been glad of his going, but I thought, too, how much kinder he was than Psyche. I never told Bardia the story of that night at all. I made one resolve before I slept, which, though it seems a small matter, made much difference to me in the years that followed. Hitherto, like all my countrywomen, I had gone barefaced. On those two journeys up the mountain I had worn a veil because I wished to be secret. I now determined that I would go always veiled. I've kept this rule within doors and without ever since. It is a sort of treaty made with my ugliness. There had been a time in childhood when I didn't yet know I was ugly. Then there was a time, for in this book I must hide none of my shames or follies, when I believed, as girls do, and as Butter was always telling me, that I could make it more tolerable by this or that done to my clothes or my hair. Now I chose to be veiled. The fox, that night, was the last man who ever saw my face, and not many women have seen it either. My arm healed well, and so all wounds have done in my body, and when the king returned, about 7 days later, I no longer pretended to be ill. He came home very drunk, for there'd been as much feasting as hunting on that party, and very out of humour, for they'd killed only 2 lions, and he'd killed neither, and a favourite dog had been ripped up. A few days later he sent for the fox and me again to the pillar room. As soon as he saw me veiled, he shouted, "Now, girl, what's this? Hung your curtains up, eh? Were you afraid we'd be dazzled by your beauty? Take off that frippery!" It was then I first found what that night on the mountain had done for me. No one who had seen and heard the god could much fear this roaring old king. "It's hard if I'm to be scolded both for my face and for hiding it," said I, putting no hand to the veil.
"Come here," he said, not at all aloud this time.
I went up and stood so close to his chair that my knees almost touched his, still as a stone. To see his face, while he could not see mine, seemed to give me a kind of power.
He was working himself into one of those white rages.
"Do you begin to set your wits against mine?" he said, almost in a whisper.
"Yes," said I, no louder than he, but very clearly. I had not known a moment before what I would do or say. That one little word came out of itself. He stared at me while you could count seven, and I half thought he might stab me dead. Then he shrugged and snarled out,
"Oh, you're like all women. Talk, talk, talk. You'd talk the moon out of the sky if a man had listened to you. Here, Fox, are those lies you've been writing ready for her to copy?"
He never struck me, and I never feared him again. And from that day I never gave back an inch before him. Rather, I pressed on, so well that I told him not long after how impossible it was that I and the Fox should guard Redivale if we were to work for him in the pillar room. He growled and cursed, yet henceforth he made Barter her jailer. Barter had grown very familiar with him of late, and spent many hours in the bedchamber. Not, I suppose, that he had her to his bed. Even in the best of her days she had scarcely been what he called savoury. But she tattled and whispered and fluttered him and stirred his possets, for he began to show his years. She was equally thick, for the most part, with Redivale, but those were a pair who could be ready to scratch each other's eyes out one moment and snuggling up for gossip and bawdy the next. This and all other things that were happening in the palace mattered to me not at all. I was like a condemned man waiting for his executioner, for I believed that some sudden stroke of the gods would fall on me very soon. But as day came after day, and nothing happened, I began to see, at first very unwillingly, that I might be doomed to live, and even to live an unchanged life, some while longer. When I understood this, I went to Psyche's room alone, and put everything in it as it had been before all our sorrows began. I found some verses in Greek which seemed to be a hymn to the god of the mountain. These I burned. I did not choose that any of that part of her should remain. Even the clothes that she had worn in the last year I burned also. But those she had worn earlier, and especially what were left of those she wore in childhood, and any jewels she had loved as a child, I hung in their proper places. I wished all to be so ordered that if she could come back she would find all as it had been when she was still happy, and still mine. Then I locked the door and put a seal on it. And as well as I could I locked a door in my mind. Unless I were to go mad, I must put away all thoughts of her, save those that went back to her first happy years. I never spoke of her. If my women mentioned her name, I bade them be silent. If the Fox mentioned it, I was silent myself and led him to other things. There was less comfort than of old in being with the Fox. Yet I questioned him much about what he called the physical parts of philosophy, about the seminal fire, and how soul arises from blood, and the periods of the universe, and also about plants and animals, and the positions, soils, airs, and governments of cities. I wanted hard things now, and to pile up knowledge. As soon as my wound was well enough, I returned very diligently to my fencing lessons with Bardia. I did it even before my left arm could bear a shield, for he said that fighting without shields was also a skill that ought to be learned. He said, and I now know it was true, that I made very good progress. My aim was to build up more and more that strength, hard and joyless, which had come to me when I heard the god's sentence, by learning, fighting, and labouring to drive all the woman out of me. Sometimes at night, if the wind howled or the rain fell, there would leap upon me like water from a bursting dam a great and anguished wonder, whether Psyche was alive and where she was on such a night, and where the hard wives of peasants were turning her cold and famished from their door. But then, after an hour or so of weeping and writhing and calling out upon the gods, I would set to and rebuild the dam. Soon Bardia was teaching me to ride on horseback as well as to fence with the sword. He used me and talked to me more and more like a man, and this both grieved and pleased me. So things went on till the midwinter, which is a great feast in our country. On the day after it, the king came home from some revels he had been at in a lord's house about 3 hours after noon, and in mounting the steps that go up into the porch he fell. It was so cold that day that the water the houseboys had used for scouring the steps had frozen on them. He fell with his right leg under him across the edge of a step, and when men ran to help him up he roared out with pain and was ready to set his teeth in the hands of anyone who touched him. Next minute he was cursing them for leaving him to lie there and freeze. As soon as I came, I nodded to the slaves to lift him up and carry him in whatever he said or did. We got him to his bed with great agony, and had the barber to him, who said, as we all guessed, that his thigh was broken. "But I've no skill to set it, lady, even if the king would let my fingers near it." I sent a messenger over to the house of Ungit to the second priest, who had the name of a good surgeon. Before he came, the king had filled himself up with enough strong wine to throw a sound man into a fever, and as soon as the second priest got his clothes out of the way and began handling the leg, he started screaming like a beast and tried to pluck out his dagger. Then Bardia and I whispered to one another, and we got in 6 of the guards and held the king down. Between his screams he kept on pointing at me with his eyes, they had his hands fast, and crying out, "Take her away! Take away that one with a veil! Don't let her torture me! I know who she is, I know!" He had no sleep that night, or the day and night after. On top of the pain from his leg, he coughed as if his chest would burst, and whenever our backs were turned, Butter would be taking him in more wine. I was not much in the bedchamber myself, for the sight of me made him frantic. He kept on saying he knew who I was for all my veil. "Master," said the fox, "it is only the Princess Orwal, your daughter."
"Aye, so she tells you," the king would say, "but I know better. Wasn't she using red-hot iron on my leg all night? I know who she is. Aye, aye, guards, Bardia, Orwal Butter, take her away!"
On the third night, the second priest and Bardia and the fox and I all stood just outside his door and talked in whispers. The second priest's name was Arnhem. He was a dark man no older than I, smooth-cheeked as a eunuch, which he cannot have been, for though Ungit has eunuchs, only a weaponed man can hold the full priesthood. "It's likely," said Arnhem, "that this will end in the king's death." "So," thought I, "this is how it will begin. There'll be a new world in Gloam, and if I get off with my life I shall be driven out. I too shall be a Psyche."
"I think the same," said the fox, "and it comes at a ticklish time. There's much business before us."
"More than you think, Lysias," said Arnhem. I'd never heard the fox called by his real name before.
The house of Ungit is in the very same plight as the king's house."
"What do you mean, Arnhem?" said Bardia.
"The priest is dying at last. If I have any skill, he'll not last 5 days."
"And you to succeed him?" said Bardia. The priest bowed his head.
"Unless the king forbids," added the fox.
This was good law in Gloam.
"It's very necessary," said Bardia, "that Ungit and the palace should be of one mind at such a moment. There are those who'd see their chance of setting Gloam by the ears otherwise."
"Yes, very necessary," said Arnhem. "No one will rise against us both."
"It's our good fortune," said Bardia, "that there's no cause of quarrel between the queen and Ungit."
"The queen?" said Arnhem.
"The queen," said Bardia and the fox, now both together. "If only the princess were married now," said Arnhem, bowing very courteously. "A woman cannot lead the armies of Gloam in war." "This queen can," said Bardia,
and the way he thrust out his lower jaw made him seem a whole army himself. I saw Arnhem looking at me hard, and I think my veil served me better than the boldest countenance in the world, maybe better than beauty would have done.
"There is only one difference between Ungit and the king's house," he said, "and that concerns the Crumbles. But for the king's sickness and the priest's, I would have been here before now to speak of it."
I knew all about this, and saw now where we were. The Crumbles was good land on the far side of the river, and it had been a cat-and-dog quarrel ever since I started working for my father as to whether it belonged, or how much of it belonged, to the king or to Ungit. I had always thought, little cause as I had to love Ungit, that it should belong to her house, which was indeed poorly provided for the charge of continual sacrifices. And I thought, too, that if once Ungit were reasonably furnished with land, the priests could be stopped from wringing so much out of the common people by way of gifts. "The king still lives," said I. I'd not spoken before, and my voice surprised them all. "But because of his sickness I am now the king's mouth. It is his wish to give the crumbles to Ungit free and for ever, and the covenant to be cut in stone, upon one condition." Bardia and the fox looked at me with wonder, but Arnhem said, "What is that, lady?" "That Ungit's guards be henceforward under the captain of the king's guard, and chosen by the king or his successor, and under his obedience." "And paid by the king or his successors, too?" said Arnhem, quick as lightning. I had not thought of this stroke, but I judged any resolute answer better than the wisest pondering. "That," said I, "must be according to the hours of duty they spend in Ungit's house and here. You drive, that is, the king drives, a hard bargain, lady," said the priest. But I knew he would take it, for I knew that Ungit had more need of good land than of spears. Also, it would be hard for Arnhem to succeed to the priesthood if the palace was against him. Then my father began roaring out from within, and the priest went back to him. "Well done, daughter," whispered the fox. "Long live the queen," whispered Bardia. Then they both followed Arnhem. I stood outside in the great hall, which was empty and the fire low. It was as strange a moment as any in my life. To be a queen, that would not sweeten the bitter water against which I had been building the dam in my soul. It might strengthen the dam, though. Then, as a quite different thing, came the thought that my father would be dead. That struck me dizzy. The largeness of a world in which he was not, the clear light of a sky in which that cloud would no longer hang. Freedom! I drew in a long breath, one way the sweetest I had ever drawn. I came near to forgetting my great central sorrow. But only for a moment. It was very still, and most of the household was in bed. I thought I heard a sound of weeping, a girl's weeping, the sound for which always, with or without my will, I was listening. It seemed to come from without, from behind the palace. Instantly, crowns and policies and my father were a thousand leagues from my mind. In a torture of hope, I went swiftly to the other end of the hall, and then out by the little door between the dairy and the guards' quarters. The moon was shining, but the air was not so still as I thought. And where now was the weeping? Then I thought I heard it again. "Psyche!" I called. "Istra! Psyche!" I went to the sound. Now I was less sure what it was. I remembered that when the chains of the well swung a little, and there had been breeze enough to sway them just now, they could make a noise something like that. Oh, the cheat of it, the bitterness! I stood and listened. There was no more weeping, but something was moving somewhere. Then I saw a cloaked form dart across a patch of moonlight and bury itself in some bushes. I was after it, quick as I could. Next moment I plunged my hand in among the branches. Another hand met it. "Softly, sweetheart," said a voice. "Take me to the king's threshold." It was a wholly strange voice, and a man's. Chapter 17 "Who are you?" said I, wrenching my hand free and leaping back as if I'd touched a snake. "Come out and show yourself." My thought was that it must be a lover of Redivals, and that Butter was playing board as well as jailer. A slender, tall man stepped out. "A suppliant," he said, but with a merriment in his voice that did not sound like supplication, "and one who never let a pretty girl go without a kiss." He'd have had an arm around my neck in a moment if I hadn't avoided him. Then he saw my dagger point twinkle in the moonlight and laughed. "You've good eyes if you can see beauty in this face," said I, turning it on him to make sure he saw the blank wall of the veil. "Only good ears, sister," said he. "I'll bet a girl with a voice like yours is beautiful." The whole adventure was, for such a woman as I, so unusual that I almost had a fool's wish to lengthen it. The very world was strange that night. But I came to my senses. "Who are you?" I said. "Tell me, quick, or I'll call the guards." "I'm no thief, pretty one," said he, "though I confess you caught me slinking in a thief's fashion. I thought there might already be some kindred of my own in your garden whom I had no mind to meet. I am a suppliant to the king. Can you bring me to him?" He let me hear a couple of coins jingle in his hand. "Unless the king's health mends suddenly, I am the queen," said I. He gave a low whistle and laughed. "If that's so, queen," he said, "I've played the fool to admiration. Then it's your suppliant I am. A suppliant for a few nights, it might be only one, lodging and protection. I am Trunia of Fars." The news struck me almost stupid. I've written before how this prince was at war with his brother Argan and the old king their father. "Defeated, then?" I said. "Beaten in a cavalry skirmish," he said, "and had to ride for it, which would be little odds but that I missed my way and blundered into Gloam, and then my horse went lame not 3 miles back. The worst of it is my brother's strength lies all along the border. If you can hide me for a day or so, his messengers will be at your door by daybreak, no doubt, so that I can get into Essur and so round to my main army in Fars, I'll soon show him and all the world whether I'm defeated." "This is all very well, prince," said I, "but if we receive you as a suppliant, we must by all law defend you. I'm not so young a queen as to think I can go to war with Fars at this time." "It's a cold night to lie out," he said. "You'd be very welcome if you were not a suppliant, prince, but in that character you're too dangerous. I can give you lodging only as a prisoner." "Prisoner," said he. "Then, queen, good night." He darted away as if he were not weary at all, though I'd heard weariness in his voice, and ran as one who is used to it. But that flight was his undoing. I could have told him where the old millstone lay. He fell sprawling, made to leap up again with wonderful quickness, then gave a sharp hiss of pain, struggled, cursed, and was still. "Sprained, if not broken," he said. "Plague on the god that invented man's ankle! Well, you may call your spears, queen. Prisoner it is. And that prison leads to my brother's hangman?" "We'll save you if we can," said I. "If we can do it anyway without full war against Fars, we'll do it." The guards' quarters were on that side of the house, as I've said, and it was easy enough to go within calling distance of the men and yet keep my eye on the prince. As soon as I heard them turning out, I said, "Pull your hood over your face. The fewer who know my prisoner's name, the freer my hands will be." They got him up and brought him hobbling into the hall and put him on the settle by the hearth, and I called for wine and victuals to be brought him and for the barber to bind up his ankle. Then I went into the bedchamber. Arnhem had gone. The king was worse, his face a darker red, his breathing hoarse. It seemed he could not speak. But I wondered, as his eyes wandered from one to another of us three, what he thought and felt. "Where have you been, daughter?" said the fox. "'His terribly weighty news. A post has just ridden in to tell us that Argan of Fars, with 3 or maybe 4 score of horse, has crossed the border and now lies but 10 miles away. He gives out that he is seeking his brother Trunia." How quickly we learned to queen or king it. Yesterday I should have cared little how many aliens in arms crossed our borders. Tonight it was as if someone had struck me in the face. "And," said Bardia, "whether he really believes that we have Trunia here, or whether he's crossed the border of a crippled land only to make a cheap show of valour and mend his mouldy reputation, either way." "Trunia is here," said I. Before their surprise let them speak, I made them come into the pillar room, for I found I could not bear my father's eyes on us. The others seemed to make no more account of him than of a dead man. I ordered lights and fire in the tower room, Psyche's old prison, and that the prince should be taken there when he had eaten. Then we three went busily to our talking. On 3 things we were all of one mind. First, that if Trunia weathered his present misfortune, he was likely enough to beat Argan in the end and rule Fars. The old king was in his dotage and counted for nothing. The longer the broils lasted, the more Trunia's party would probably increase, for Argan was false, cruel, and hated by many, and had, moreover, from his first battle, long before these troubles, an old slur of cowardice upon him which made him contemptible. Second, that Trunir as King of Fars would be a far better neighbour to us than Argan, especially if we had befriended him when he was lowest. But thirdly, that we were in no